I always have an AA meeting. My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." So tonight, all the way from Gainesville Classic Group, is Sam P. And Sam has traveled quite a ways to come and share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Thank you so much, Sam.
Hey, everybody. My name is Sam, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, Sam. My sobriety date is 6/1/2015, so that puts me just over 8 years of recovery in this program. And it's been some of the most challenging yet beautiful years of my life. I was born in November of 1983, which for those of you who are not good at math like me, that's about 40 years ago, so I'm about to turn 40. Thinking back to my childhood and my early stages of addiction, I never thought I would make it to 40. And here I stand, if I make it another week, I'll be 40. And that's another minor miracle in this program. Hey. I was born to a loving family. My mom and dad, you know, were both loving parents. They divorced when I was three, and so then I went to live with my mom. A stepdad came into my life when I was five, so there was started just a little chip on my shoulder. They ended up having a couple more kids over the years, so I had some age on them, so I was the oldest of three in the house. But I was the stepchild, and I was to some degree treated like such, and that just grew that little chip. As I got older into my teenage years, you know, I started seeing more differences in the way I was treated. But, you know, everything was, you know, normal. Now, I never had to worry about food. I never had to worry about shoes. You know, I was taken care of. I grew up going to church. That's a part of my story. I was very active in church. I had a pretty good social life in church for a kid. Around the age of 15, I think, is when things really started to change. Let me back up. When I was 10, I took my first drink. I was visiting with my father, and we went on these camping trips every couple times a year. And the guys would all get drunk. And I saw that, and I watched that, and I saw that as something men do. That's what men do. Men have fun, they laugh, and they drink whatever's in those cans. So I emulated that and wanted to be that. So the first opportunity I got, I drank. I got drunk the first time. I was 10 years old. I did try another form of alcohol by the time I was 11, but I never really had that freedom to be able to drink like I wanted. Around when I was 15, I really started rebelling against my stepdad, and that grew very quickly into almost a hatred. You know, he stood in front of me is what he did. And when I got 16 and I got my license, all bets were off. You know, then I could go to places, do what I want. I had a job, so I had a little money in my pocket, and I spent it on booze and other forms of alcohol. I fell in love quickly with being intoxicated. Fell in love with it immediately. I never drank to have a couple beers. Never. I always drank with the intent of getting drunk. It changed the way I felt, and I wasn't happy in my own skin. Now, I didn't realize that I wasn't happy in my own skin until I got sober, so I never really knew why I did it. But I did, and it continued, and other forms of alcohol had a huge presence in my late teens and early 20s. I got into some trouble with the law when I was 18. My first DUI. surprise, surprise, you drive around drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning in Stockbridge, Georgia. Yeah, you're gonna get pulled over. So I got my first charge. I was still in high school at the time. I was still attending high school. I wasn't really in school. They made me go, and that's about all I did while I was there. I didn't graduate, but I did graduate with a misdemeanor, which was I thought was cool at the time. You know, badge of honor. That didn't really work out for me being on probation. I couldn't drink and I couldn't enjoy other forms of alcohol. And so probation, you know, it's kind of set up to catch people who are doing that. So I got caught a few times and they ended up with me in jail. So I spent, I think, about 6 months in jail off of a DUI. I vowed when I was locked up to, as soon as I got out, I was going to commit my life to doing everything I could to stay intoxicated as much as possible and not get caught. That didn't work out so well. It did work. It did work for about 11 years, though. I was good at it. I got good at hiding it. I got good at hiding it from family. I got good at hiding it from my wife at the time. She knew I did things, but she didn't know how bad it was. That progressed until I started leaving the other forms of alcohol alone about the time I was 23 and became a full-time drunk at that time. There was no steady transition. There was no, like, I mean, it was drink to get drunk, you know, as soon as I got rid of those other forms. My dad passed away. My biological father passed away when I was 25. It was a very tragic thing. He fell over, had a seizure, had the wife flight him. I was his only son, so I had to be the one that makes the call to pull him off of life support. And at 25, borderline alcoholic at the time, that was not something I dealt with well. And so my drink did what? It increased. That's when everything really changed from beer to liquor. Throughout my story, there was a lot of switching back and forth and trying this because this isn't working. Let's try that because that's not working. And nothing ever worked. I just didn't know how to handle my feelings. I didn't know what to do with the pain. I remember thinking that I just wanted to get away. I wanted to flee. I wanted to run away from the problem. I couldn't escape, so I escaped into a bottle. That became, you know, at that point, that was entirely my crutch. My only thing that I had that I felt was, you know, my friend. I mean, it was closer to me than my wife was. It was closer to me than anybody in my life was. I was a servant of King Alcohol at that time. And that progressed for many years. I started having some health problems. Drink a bottle of liquor every day, you know, it tends to give you health problems. I was diagnosed with the beginning stages of cirrhosis when I was 29. Guess what? I didn't stop drinking. That wasn't enough for me. About 6 months after that, though, I was just tired of the DTs every day, fighting with it, trying to hide this drink. By this time, my wife was all over my tail. My marriage wasn't good. You know, my job wasn't good. I was barely hanging on. I had enough. And so talked to my wife, and we checked me into a detox center in Gainesville, where I stayed for, I think, 5 or 6, 7 days, somewhere in there. Got out. I think I went to one meeting. But I felt good when I got out. I was, you know, I was free of the alcohol. I had a clear mind. Like, I had energy again. I was like, this is great. This is wonderful. And then I decided, well, maybe I can have a drink, and it happened to be Halloween. I was like, maybe I had a drink with Halloween. I was going to have a rum and coke while we passed out candy to the kids. I don't know why that sounded like a good idea, but I'm an alcoholic. You know, none of my good ideas are great. I went and bought a bottle, and of course I bought, as like a responsible alcoholic, I bought the big one. You know, because I mean, it's more economic, right? And next thing I know, I'm getting yelled at. I'm like, what? What is the problem? And she's like, you're drunk. And I was like, I just had the one. You know, I just had the one drink. And she's like, half the bottle's gone. And that's when I realized, I might have a problem. Of course, that I was right off to the races, and it was worse than it ever was. I made it for another year, and then at that time, I'd gotten to a bad place again, shaking all the time, you know, having to wake up in the morning and you know, drink, throw up, just to get enough alcohol in me to make it through the day, or not the day, but to walk out the door, try to hold down the job, and a year like that, and I was done again. Went back into detox, was there 5, 6, 7 days, whatever, and got out. And this time I didn't feel good. I felt empty. I felt broken. I felt like something was missing. And the only thing I knew to do was stop at the liquor store on my way home from detox. And off to the races I went again. This time it only lasted 6 months, and I hope that this was my last bender, I guess as you would call it. I met my uncle to go fishing on the lake, Lake Lanier up there where I'm from. Was on the way back. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, Memorial Day weekend. I was miserable. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. That childhood idea of what God was that I got from my parents making me go to church kind of resurfaced for once. And I was like, I didn't really believe in anything, but there was just a silent prayer into whatever. Like, help me get a way out of this. Right about that time, I fell asleep at the wheel. Crossed the double yellow lines and got involved in a head-on collision. 5 people went to the hospital. 1 of them was not able to go home. She stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks, fighting for her life, multiple surgeries, before she passed away. I wouldn't find this out for about a month. I was in the hospital as well. Georgia State Patrol came to see me and told me when I got out I would have a charge waiting for me and I have to go to jail. And nobody knew like the seriousness at that time, so they let me out. I went and saw a lawyer. He said, you got to go to jail. I said, okay. And he's like, yeah, when you get out of jail, you're going to have to go to treatment. And he said, long-term residential treatment. So I got out, and the treatment center wouldn't take me because I went in and they bonded me out the next day, so I was like still shaking. And they're like, you can't come here until you get cleared. Or you make it 3 days or something like that. And so I had to spend a day at home without taking a drink. And luckily I didn't have a vehicle. My wife at the time was not going to let me go. And so I sat there and didn't drink. And that was day one of my sobriety. I did end up going to treatment. I stayed in that treatment center for about 30 days. It was a long-term treatment, but I didn't want to be there when I got there. But they made me go to NA and AA meetings and I'm having to listen to y'all and I didn't want to listen to y'all. It was while I was there that I got the news that the woman I had hit had passed away. And that's also when I found out that it was 2 grandparents and their 2 grandkids. When I got that news, y'all, I didn't want to live anymore. I was done. So I made a plan. I got out. I wormed my way and manipulated my way. Because I'm an alcoholic, I'm good at manipulating. I manipulated my way out of the treatment center and ended up getting my wife to come pick me up. She took me home. I waited for her to go to bed. I walked upstairs and I grabbed my gun. And something that happened in that little bit of time where I was in that treatment center, coming in these rooms, listening to y'all stuff, a little voice inside my head while I'm playing with the slack and the trigger with a pistol in my mouth said that I didn't want to hurt anybody anymore. And if I pulled that trigger, I was going to hurt people. I was going to hurt my family. My wife was going to hear that, run upstairs, see that. I was going to hurt somebody. And for the first time in I don't know how long my whole life, I thought about somebody else. And I thought that I just, okay, let's, there's this other treatment center that they want me to go to. Let's give it what I would learn to call an honest appraisal. So the next day I went into a long-term residential treatment center. It saved my life, 100%. I was there for 1.5 years while I was out on bond. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. Somewhere in there, probably about step 3, you know, they're talking about this higher power, you know, this power greater than yourself. And I couldn't face that childhood knowledge of what I knew as God. I couldn't face that. That was too much for me to take on at the time. But a higher power, okay, spirit of the universe, if you will, I could entertain that. It got me through step 2. And in step 3, I am, like, having to turn over all that freedom that I had won for so long, realizing that I never really had that freedom while I was drinking. I fought with it. I wrestled with it. My sponsor made me memorize the 3rd step prayer. And he's like, okay, go get somewhere quiet. Get on your knees and say the prayer, but mean it. Mean it with everything you are. And I did. I did that. Something at that time, it was like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. It was like, I don't have to do this by myself. I can't describe the feeling. The only way I know to describe it is called a spiritual experience. at that time, I was like, okay, well, maybe there's something to this. Maybe this program can do something for me. And so I dedicated myself to, I'm going to do the 12 steps. I'm going to do the 12 steps with Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did step 4, and in step 5, I was like, all right, now I get to tell somebody about all these resentments. So I was excited to do my 5th step. I didn't like writing down the 4th step, but I was excited to do the 5th step. Because I got to talk about me. But I rattled something off the list, and he's like, okay, now what's your part in it? Like, what do you mean my part? You know, you just hear what this guy did to me? And he's like, no, what's your part in that? And I was like, well, I guess I could have done this different, and if I hadn't have done this, I wouldn't have been in that situation. And he's like, oh, that's your part. And then I was like, okay, move on to the next one. Tell him my, whatever it was. And he's like, okay, what's your part in it? It was one of those moments of clarity, as we've come to call them. And I realized then that all of my problems were of my own making. There was this big light bulb moment. And you talk to any earthlings, normies, people that aren't like us, and they would be like, well, duh. You know, but for me, this hard-headed, selfish, self-centered alcoholic, that was just a mind-blowing revelation. I didn't know what to make of that. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe I got some of these character defects. Work those steps. Okay, well, and then I'm still working those. I made it through the steps, and I felt different. My 9th step was a little different. My wife, I did my 9th step with my wife, and she said, let me get back to you. 3 months later, she's ready to get back to me with a big notebook full of stuff. That was fun. But you know what? I didn't feel like I had done the steps until after I took that tongue lashing. Because I deserved it. I deserved every bit of that. I kind of speed through the steps because that's really where my story starts, you know, for the most part. Like, I had to deal with the wreckage of my past. I had to go to prison sober. I spent 3.5 years in prison, which was only God. That's the only way I could tell it. I could have gotten a lot more time. I did get more time, but some things, God got involved. It's the only way I know to just tell you. The first year I was in prison was not fun at all. I was at a level 5 lockdown camp. It was not fun. I saw people get stabbed. I saw people get thrown off the top of balconies. It was not fun. And there was no AA there. But I had a loving sponsor that answered the phone every time I called. And I had a Grapevine subscription. And I had a big book. And that got me through that first year. If it wasn't for any of those three things, other forms of alcohol and alcohol itself are very prevalent in prison. It was not fun. So then I got the availability to go to a program called REACT. It's a state-funded program that allowed me to go up to Hall County work camp, like the prison work camp, which is Hall County's in, you know, that's where Gainesville's at. So I got to go to my home county instead of being way down south and do my time there. They let me go out every day and work a detail in stripes, you know, with the work I had done in my 20s, I knew a little bit about doing electrical work, so I got on an electrical work detail doing what I did, but just for the county and, like, the county buildings. And also, they had AA there. And I said, sign me up. I don't care whatever. There's an AA meeting. Let me get there. And boy, let me tell you, that first AA meeting I walked into, I don't think I shut up the whole hour. It saved me. And there was also a little program they had there called Celebrate Recovery, which was another recovery group. So I got 2 meetings a week. You know, it's not the same as AA, but it's 12 steps and it's God-centered. And you know what? That works for me. Sign me up. So I got there and, like, some of the guys I was in the dorm with, like, didn't always look at me like they wanted to stab me. So that was a little bit better too. But there were still other forms of alcohol. When I started getting those meetings again, I started feeling better about myself. I started feeling more confident in my recovery. I started feeling like I had unity back. Because that first year in recovery, in prison, was, the way my sponsor put it, I was missing 2 sides of the triangle. You know, we have 3 sides of the triangle, and it's unity, service, and recovery. And basically all I had was my own recovery I was leaning on. I didn't have the unity of the program besides the random calls I would give my sponsor. And I certainly didn't have service because there wasn't anybody getting sober down there. But I did the best I could. And when I got to the Hall County camp, you know, and I got those meetings, I started, you know, trying to build back my life. And one day I get a letter and it says, hey, you're going to get out in like 6 months or something like that. And I was like, oh, sweet, they're letting me out early. So they took me and they transitioned me to what's called a transition center, which meant I wore street clothes. I went and got a real job. It was like halfway in, halfway out kind of deal. And I did that for like the 6 months or whatever and got me a good job, making good money, doing electrical work. They were like, okay, all right, you're going to get out in a few days. They sent me to do my blood work, and I was 3 days from going home. And they said, when I came in from work, they said, hey, come talk to me. They're not going to let you out. They're actually going to extend your time, and which was a real heartbreaker. And they extended it by 2 years. So, I mean, it was that buildup of I'm going home, and then just getting the rug snatched out from under me. I was like, okay, well, I can deal with it. I had to go back into the actual prison, put on the stripes again. It got worse from there. I called my mom and said, Mom, I was supposed to get out, but they've extended my time. And it's going to be 2 more years. And my mom says, well, I've got some bad news for you, too. I've got 2 years to live. I've got cancer. It gets worse. Then my wife comes to visit me that weekend, and she says, I can't wait 2 more years. I want a divorce. All within 2 weeks. Again. Rug snatched out from under me. Don't know where to turn. Don't know what to do. Couldn't talk to people about it. Like, I talked to the guys I could that were doing what I was doing, but nothing was working. I couldn't run, right? All I could do was pray and learn to become reliant on my higher power. And that's when I did. I just prayed and I prayed and I prayed, and somehow I made it through it. God got involved again. And so guess what? You're only going to have to do like a few months, and then we're going to give you back to the TC. So I only did like 4 months back in stripes and ended up back in the transitional center working my job, making money, which happily they saved up for me. When I was in that transitional center too, I was getting to go to outside meetings, real meetings in my home group, and see my sponsor. My sponsor picked me up because I had to do another 4-step at that time. You know, after everything that had happened, I needed another 4-step. And I did it, and I did the 5th with him. My life started getting better. I started letting go of things. I started letting go because when I was getting sober in treatment, I still had a home, and I still had a wife. I hadn't lost all of that. This selfish alcoholic had, like, that little sense of superiority, that ego, you know. I haven't lost everything. I didn't have to lose everything. God saw fit that I did lose everything because I didn't have anywhere to live, didn't have a wife. You know, I started at scratch, and I think that's the way God wanted it. Because I got to start over with a clean slate. I started looking at things with that positive perspective. And so at that time, I was like, okay, well, it's time to rebuild my life. You know, eventually they did let me out. They let me out with a little cash in my pocket, enough to buy a vehicle. I went to live with my aunt for a while because she was local. I made sure that I hit the ground running on a good, healthy set of habits. I'm making sure every morning, waking up, doing my prayers, doing my meditation, doing what I need to. Like, I think I was doing 5 meetings a week, and at this time I had 4 or 5 years, somewhere in there, years of recovery, and I was hitting 5 meetings a week because that's what I knew I needed. Got involved with a bunch of different meetings that weren't there when I was getting sober in treatment. Putting the healthy people in my life and surrounding myself with those folks because I heard the statistics when I was in treatment, you know, that, you know, it's like 12% of people who get sober stay sober or something like that. And then I heard it was like 3% of addicts who get sober stay sober. And then they pump you full of statistics when you're in those prison classes they make you there. When they tell you that only 27 people who go to prison don't come back, you know, the recidivism rate's 73%. And so I'm like looking at all these statistics and like, well, if I want to succeed, I have got to do absolutely everything in my power that I can do to succeed. And that's just simply what I had to do, or I could face relapse. I didn't want to go back down that road. Certainly didn't want to go to prison. So that's what I've done. That's what I've been doing. After I had been out about 6 months, my lawyer called me. And he said, hey, I got some news for you. And I was like, it better be good news. I was like, I've done my time. And he's like, yeah, it is. The son of the woman that I killed wanted to meet me. I said, I don't know if I can do that. I'm on parole. I don't know. He said, I've already worked it out. You're going to do it here. You're going to be with me in my office. I said, okay. I was like, he's not going to, like, go crazy or anything on me, is he? He's like, no, he wants to talk to you. And this man, y'all, wanted to meet me to forgive me. No words. Not only that, but he didn't want me to feel like I had a chip on my shoulder and never live up to potential. That's the power of God. And again, more motivation for me to keep doing the next right thing. You know, when I was doing the steps and when I was doing everything else, you know, one of the things that, the sayings that stuck in my head that still is very so true to me today is, if I am not the problem, there is no solution. And I kind of took that to heart in my recovery. Like, if I want to go backwards, it's me that's the problem, right? And so that meeting with that man, like, was even more of a catalyst and more of a drive for me to keep doing the right thing. Now, it hasn't been all roses and sunshine since then. I was able to get out before that 2 years that they extended me. Again, God. And I was able to spend a final holiday season with my mom. And that's nothing short of God right there. Because guess what? She died right at 2 years when she told me. If God hadn't gotten involved and I hadn't gotten out, I wouldn't have gotten to spend that last Christmas with my mother. Sadly, she died of cancer, bone cancer. But I got to do something I never thought I'd do. I got to be the shoulder for my family to cry on. My little sister, my little brother, my stepdad were asking me, how do I get through this? Because I knew I'd lost my dad. You know? How to, you know, help me with this. And I had learned in treatment grief, how to process grief. You know, all these tools and stuff that we learn in this program, you know, normies and nerdlings, they don't have them. You know, a lot of them don't work on us on themselves like we do. And I was able to share that with them. And they were able to learn, and we've been able to repair relationships. I get along with my stepdad now. It's funny, I quit drinking, I get along with people. But after that, I was really dedicated to rebuilding my life. Bought a little house up just north of Gainesville. It was a little house, but it was mine. And I love that little place because it was my new like spot of freedom, the freedom to do the things I wanted to. You know, I could do my meditation when I wanted to. I could do meetings when I wanted to. But I was also dating at the time. I was dating and I wasn't having the best luck dating. And surprise, surprise, alcoholic. learned a little bit about myself. Kind of had a heart-to-heart with my sponsor and a couple other guys in the program. Opened my eyes a little bit. I met a woman in a meeting. It was funny, you know, I'd never dated another alcoholic before, but dating somebody in recovery was an absolutely wonderful experience because we worked on like a relationship and that was interesting and new and I wouldn't change it for the world and today she's my wife and she's sitting right back there. That has been one of the coolest things is having a true relationship and that's what sobriety has afforded me, the ability to have a true relationship with people. And that is just absolutely awesome. I got really frustrated doing electrical work. And guess what? I got involved. I said, God, I'm very frustrated working 13 days on, one day off, 12-hour days. And I need a change, but I don't just want to change jobs. I want to better my life. And again, you know, when God wants to be there, you know, he's there when you ask him. You know, he's there. It doesn't always give you what you want, but he gives me what I need, and I was able to get a better job. You know, I came up doing construction, 30 booths, you know, coming home smelling eye heaven every day. Now I have an office job. I work in engineering. I'm not an engineer. I didn't go to college. I didn't graduate high school. But that's where God wanted me. I feel I have a purpose as God intends it today. And I am actually okay with God's plan. You know, it's no longer I'm fighting God's plan. It's I'm embracing God's plan. If you'd have asked me if to write down everything I wanted in the first 5 years in recovery, I'd have sold myself short. 100%. Because I have a life today that I never dreamed of having, and I'm actually, knock on wood, if I make another week, get to celebrate 40 years when I thought I'd be dead by now. You know, when diagnosed with cirrhosis at age 29, I should be dead by now. And that's yet another piece of motivation. You know, I've been to jails. I've been to institutions. I know what's left. And that's, again, more motivation for me. That is my story. But I thank y'all for being here. Y'all can have a meeting without me, but I can't have a meeting with y'all without y'all. Thank you.
Sam, thank you so much. That was a very powerful, very special story. Thank you so much for sharing. We have asked Tim to give the shit.
Hey, everybody. Hey. Folks are saying that we have a spiritual sacrament. When we get started in this program for the first time, we come back. We offer a white shirt here.
All right.
Woo-hoo! Anybody with 30 days? That's good.
All right.
The big 6-0, anybody got 60 days? I have 90 days. A little blood back in the alcohol stream. 90 days. 6 months, yellow. 9 months, green. Blue chip.
My name is Hilton W. I'm an eyeball. This makes year number 30.
Nice.
I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous at age 26 years old. There was a lot of experience. Probably one of the only reasons why I stayed was the cigarettes and the coffee. You know, I could not relate to anybody. And I was like, I was trying to figure out some things. I knew I didn't want to go back where I came.
One more blue chip for somebody?
Me. Hey. Hi, everybody. I'm Ellen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Hi. This is 4 years. All I can say is this is 4 years coming back from a really, really, really scary and deathly relapse, basically. Mm-hmm. When I wanted to die and I was begging to die, my God was saying, you're not going to die because I'm here and you've got a purpose, and right here is what my purpose is.
Yeah.
And that is to show you and anybody else in here that it can be done as long as you work the program, stay in the rooms and stay connected, get a sponsor, be honest. Because honesty or dishonesty is what took me down. And that is, I'll feed them what I want them to know and then I'll just work it out behind here. So that's what has kept me here and will always keep me here. And service work is definitely the one thing that will keep you sober.
One last chance for a white chip tonight. If not tonight, come back tomorrow.
Keep coming back.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Tim.
On the chips you hold.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
You took a rolling stop through the old playground. It ain't what you thought, but look at what you found. The beautiful thing that you love so hard. Just an old newspaper blowing across the yard. There's a raveling thread in the old rag top. A board in the window where you used to shop. Pull a cracked up smile from a pissed off wind. You put your foot through the door when you can't come in. Empty glass, shady past, you'll find sometime. And it's strange how you've changed. You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem now. Well, the angel's arms are full of holes. She walks it off outside where it's nice and cold. There's a sad soul song that you used to share. There's a vacant space where you used to care. You're a spark in the dark, hey, you burn somehow. On your way, like they say. You're nobody's problem now. Nobody's problem. When the sun comes up, we'll still be here. When we've had enough, we'll still be here. When the flame is blown, we'll still be here. When it all comes home, we'll still. There's weeds in the walk where the home place leans. Cattails crying in a dried up stream. You take a long deep breath and blow it out slow. You bring the same old shadow everywhere you go. You're a spark in the dark, hey, you burn somehow. Ain't it strange how you've changed? You're nobody's problem now. You're nobody's problem.